I'm going to hand over to Such Your Money, there she is, who's going to introduce Dom.
Okay, so it's absolutely delightful to have Dom dinner with us in Croydon. She was ordained by Sangha Ratchita over 40 years ago. She was very young. So she has a very long association and friendship with Sangha Ratchita, so it was particularly delightful to have her here to talk about that. And I think she's somebody who has a very deep understanding and experience of the Dharma. It looks like it's very much in her bones, and then that just really comes out in the way she lives her life. And she's taken on a lot of responsibilities in our movement and order over the years. Currently she still holds quite a lot of responsibilities, and I think she's one of the most hard working people I know. I did offer to send her Floridix through the post, didn't I? To keep her going, but she said she'd rather have chocolate. Yeah. I think she's somebody who finds that sort of holding quite a depth of responsibility with quite a lightness and playfulness. She doesn't seem to get too weighed down by it all. Something very light about her touch. And I think most importantly somehow, she's one of the most loved order members. Yeah.
That's nice, isn't it?
Isn't it? Yeah. So, really lovely to hear what it is you want to talk to us about. Thank you.
Well, it's very nice to be here. I was part of the Croydon Centre many, many, many years ago. I don't remember. My memory of dates is not so good these days, but I think it must have been late 70s, early 80s. I lived in a women's community in Leatherhead. That's where we lived. And I think the cafe was in West Croydon. Mm. Yeah. And then the community moved to Streatham, and then it moved to Brixton. But, you know, we were associated with the Croydon Centre, and the Croydon Centre was in Ariatara, I think, at that point. So yeah, I had a couple of years, a long time ago, when I was involved with, not this physical centre, but with the Croydon Centre. So I'm going to talk about my relationship with Sangha Ratchita. I think that's what I was asked to talk about, yes. So yeah, I've had a very long relationship with him as a teacher, as a friend. He's my preceptor. He's the founder of our movement. So it's got lots of different facets to it, and it covers a long period of time. So I met him in 1970. It's a long time ago. So I'll give you a little bit of background about me. So when I met him, I was just 24, I think, and I think he must have been about 45. So I'm very young, and he's kind of in his prime, I guess. But before I met him, I'd thought of myself as a Buddhist for about 3 years, actually, and I'd read quite a lot of books, mainly Tibetan Buddhist books, because there was very little available then. When you think about now, and you think about, you know, the number of translations and books in a bookshop around Buddhism and all the stuff on the internet, there's an enormous amount of material. And then, you know, I used to go to a library near where I worked, and it was the sort of alternative religious shelves, you know. So the shelves were about that long, the Buddhist books were about that much, and I read them all. So yeah, I considered myself a Buddhist, and then I wanted to kind of explore that, and I tried going various places. So I went to the Buddhist Society, which, you know, still exists, but I found that a bit, dare I say now, middle class and middle aged, and everybody sat on chairs. You have to kind of be humble, don't you, in the end? Yeah, it wasn't quite, as a young kind of wild hippie, it wasn't quite, didn't quite meet my needs, as it were. So I went to various places exploring, and I went to a place called, in Chelsea, called Gandalf's Garden. It's a kind of bookshop, an alternative shop. And I went to a talk there. I hadn't realised what kind of... I knew it was kind of a mystical talk, but actually the man talking was more Hindu, so that didn't suit me either. But the shop had a little newsletter that it produced. And on the back page of the newsletter was a list of all the alternative spiritual groups in London at the time on an A4 sheet. So again, it wouldn't be like that now. And I sort of went off with a news sheet, and I also have a scientific background, so I kind of methodically wrote to every group on the back of the sheet and got all this information back, some of which was extraordinarily wacky, like the Aetherius Society, which... Well, some of you may believe this, I don't know. Believes that we came, you know, from outer space to the Earth and flying saucers. So I kind of worked my way through it and wrote to people and got letters back. And the letters I got back from what was then the FWBM, is now Tree Ratna, I got a really lovely letter back, very kind of sensible. And they sent me their newsletter. And... they invited me to, you know, there's a lecture series on if you come, you know, come to the reception and we'll kind of look after you. But I was incredibly shy at that point in my life and really quite withdrawn. And to do something like that was, you know, really very, very challenging for me. So although the invite was there, I couldn't really do it at that point. And but there was an advert in the newsletter for a yoga class, and I thought, oh, I need to do something with my body. You know, I'm a bit not incarnated. I need to do this. So that would be good. So I went to yoga, and I went to yoga for about 6 months, and it was very, very good. And I was married at the time, and I was, as I say, very, very shy, and my partner was really quite extrovert, so I'd say to him, like, I'd really like to go to that, will you come with me? And he'd go, oh, yeah, yeah. So he'd always kind of come and enjoy whatever it was. He's now an order member of Mountain Badger, who you may know. So one day, the yoga teacher, who, you know, had an English name, came into the yoga class and said, I've got a booking sheet for a Buddhist retreat. So I thought, this is a sign, this is it, finally. You know. Probably can do that. And again, I said to my partner, will you come with me? So we headed off on this Easter retreat in 1970. And I have a very vivid memory of it. So we went off on our little motorbike, the pair of us. And it was Easter and it was snowing. And we turned up at this stately home, kind of big house, somewhere in Surrey, I think it was. And arrived on this retreat, having not met any of these people before. And, you know, people were very, very friendly. The retreat was going on. People were lovely. There were people of our age, quite a lot of people of our age, you know, early 20s, and people of all ages, actually. On that retreat, there was three ladies that I thought was very old, but they're probably my age now. No, they were older than that, actually. I think they were in their kind of 80s, actually, who sat on the sofa in the lounge and knitted. And I just loved it that it was kind of all ages. Yeah, very, very welcoming. So I learned to meditate finally after these years of trying to find out how to do that. And we booked for 2 days because we were quite sort of cautious about how this would be. And thought, this is great. You know, I really liked doing the mindfulness, reading the Metta Bhavana. I really felt, oh, this is what I, you know, I need to be, this is what I need to be doing, meditating. And then one day this person turns up in the lounge, and it's Sangharakshita. So I'd heard the name Sangharakshita because I'd read the newsletter. But I guess I thought he was going to be a Theravadan monk, the name Sangharakshita. Mm-hmm. And he'd been in America teaching a seminar in Yale, and he'd been away for quite some time. He came straight to the retreat. So in the lounge where we all gathered was this guy, this person, and he was very, very friendly with people. Obviously people, you know, were very, very happy to see him. He was very warm, very friendly. And I was completely fascinated by him because he didn't look like a Theravada monk at all. So you've seen pictures probably of early Sangharakshita, if you've, you know, had much to do with us as a movement. So this is the Sangharakshita with the very long hair, kind of unwashed, really. he is in an orange robe, you know, Theravadan robe, but it's a little bit grubby. He's in a maroon polo neck, when it is Easter, slippers, and a Tibetan mala, and his teeth weren't very good nick in those days. So he just didn't fit the picture I had of what a Theravada monk was supposed to look like. And he was English, which I hadn't kind of realised. And yeah, just kind of very friendly. So I was kind of quite fascinated by him. I couldn't, and haven't been able to since really, sort of, it's very hard to pigeonhole Bhante or, you know, decide quite what sort of person he is. So then that evening, there was a lecture on the programme that was going to take place in the Shrine. And I don't think we'd had a lecture in the evening before. This is like 3 days into my retreat. And so he turned up in the Shrine room. And I've told this story many times, but it's still very vivid in my memory. He sat on the chair with a reel-to-reel tape recorder next to him, and the tape of one of his lectures played on the tape recorder, which is a bit odd, because there he was. And he laughed at all his own jokes. It's sort of endearing. but I had a very, very strong experience in the Shrine. So I'd been, you know how I think when you go on your first retreat and everything kind of changes very, very quickly, doesn't it? And things kind of open up. And so that had already happened to some extent. But it had mainly been meditation and, you know, a bit of discussion. So I heard this talk coming out of the tape recorder, and I knew it was from Sangharakshita. And I think one of the things about Bhante is he's very, very clear. His Dharma teaching is very, very clear. So I'd read a lot of books that I'd learned a certain amount from, and then I'd go, oh, I can't write, you know, so Tibetan or so going off in some, I don't know if I can, I can't quite get all that. But this was very, very clear. So it had a great deal of clarity. I can't remember which of the Eightfold Path series it was. They're all brilliant. And, you know, incredible profundity. It had both, you know, kind of depth and clarity. And I appreciate clarity. And I just felt I met the Dharma's truth in that moment. Something kind of happened to me that... It's a very, very deep resonance. I remember thinking, this sort of strange experience, like I thought I knew what he was going to say before he said it, which of course there's no way I knew what he was going to say, but you know that was the kind of strength of that sort of resonance with the truth. So that's a very fundamental experience in the beginning of my Dharma life. You know, it's a kind of, I don't know, a little bit of glimpse of perfect vision, I guess, you know. And I knew it was connected with him, that he was going to be my teacher. So that was very strong. And I think it is a touchstone experience. So, you know, many, many years have passed. All sorts of things have happened in my life. All sorts of things have happened in his life. You know, ups and downs. You know, relationships change over time. You hit difficulties or misunderstandings. And there have been times, particularly in my early life in the order, where... You know, things be so tough, I think, oh, I can't, you know, it's just too hard, isn't it, the spiritual life? It's a hard thing to try and do to sort of change yourself. And I thought, well, maybe I can't do it, you know. But that experience was always there as a kind of, it stopped me going off and doing something else or giving up. So that can be quite challenging, can't it, that you've got something that you can't sort of quite go against. You would think your life would be easier if I don't know, and often got a job in a shop or something. Not there's anything wrong with a job in a shop. So that was my first experience of meeting Sangharakshita, and that was it really, because although I stayed on retreat for a couple more days, it seemed like a lifetime in a positive way, he got very sick. I guess he'd flown back from America, and he just disappeared, and there was kind of... As a newbie, he had a sense of something going on that was kind of serious. And I learned later that he'd come down with bronchial pneumonia. So he was on the retreat and he was just very sick and being looked after by a couple of people who were medical. And I think he was very, very ill indeed. So he must have, I don't know what happened. I left the retreat, presumably he recuperated. He went back to the States and... I didn't see him again for maybe a few months. But I felt I'd found my place. You know, I'd found my teacher, I'd understand the Dharma and this kind of range of people that I'd met on that retreat, I can really kind of communicate with. And I just started to go to the nearest centre, which was a little shop in Monmouth Street, Sakura, and meditate and make friends. And so then eventually Sangharakshita came back from the States, and then he was the main teacher at that centre while that centre was in existence. So I'd go twice a week, and he would teach us to meditate, and then there'd always be questions and answers. I can't remember, you know, the questions and answers, what they were, but they were always fascinating. People would ask all sorts of things, not just about meditation. And yeah, he was just very, very good at just answering the question, answering what you needed, and so on and so forth. So I was around a lot. So in those days, we had not very many retreats. We had an Easter retreat, a summer retreat, you know, long, a week or 10 days, and then maybe an odd weekend. So two classes a week at a centre. Not in a way, it wasn't very kind of much to come to, but I was going to be there all the time. And at some point, I guess, because I was there a lot, I think I must have got into some sort of communication with Sangharakshita. So I decided to help out, because I could see that he sort of did everything. He didn't exactly make the tea, but he just took on a lot. And actually, sometimes he did make the tea in the class, actually. And I just felt, oh, me and a few friends thought he needed some help to do things. So yeah, one of the things I think about him was that I was very, very shy. I had an extrovert partner. I kind of hid behind him, you know. And yet, Sangharakshita kind of noticed me and, you know, made an attempt to kind of communicate with me and get to know me. I think, I feel that's very important, isn't it? I think he could see the keenness through the shyness and the aspiration, and that he just kind of met that, and that's just so important, isn't it? You know, so important when people come to the centre here that you go out and meet them. So that had a big impact on me. So I began to sort of help out and do things, and so Bhante's a great teacher, and has been my teacher for many years. And of course, in that period, you know, of his life, you know, for a long time, he was teaching in the movement. He's not doing that at the moment. He's 90 this year, so he's having a quieter time, as it were. Not that he's not communicating with people, or he's not kind of letting it known, you know, what he's thinking about, but he's not kind of publicly teaching. So one of the ways he taught early on was the lecture series. So those lecture series are all kind of, they're all taped. They're all now on Free Buddhist Audio, aren't they? And still worth listening to. I think they form the basis of the Mitra study. So some of them had already taken place, but I went to some of those lecture series, you know, live, because they were happening. So I went to the Higher Evolution of Man live, which I remember nothing about, actually, except helping to make the tea and make the sandwiches beforehand. But I did go to the Tantric series live, and I was so excited to go to that lecture series because I was very interested in Tibetan Buddhism. And that took place at the new centre that we'd acquired. So this is the first North London centre up in near Archway. So an old piano factory with a big open space downstairs and a tea bar and a shrine room, a little bit bigger than this upstairs, I think. So it wasn't like a mass audience. So Bhante came every week and talked about the creative symbols of the tantric path to enlightenment. And I was so keen. I sat in the front row and I just fell asleep. You know that thing, you know, in meditation when you're kind of like that. And I just kind of... And I think it was the kind of... His energy in those days, Bhante's energy was very, very strong. You know, the kind of... Yeah, he just had a lot of energy, not just physical energy. I suppose it was spiritual energy. And when he was focused and teaching, you kind of... you're on the receiving end of something very, very, very profound and strong. So each week, there were 8 weeks, I'd move a bit further back. It still happened. You know, I don't know if you've been in a... You've probably fallen asleep in many of Bhante's lectures if you've listened to them on tape, because there's sort of soothing voice in some ways. But it's a sort of way you can go to sleep, isn't there, where you're kind of asleep, but you're still, you can still hear, you're still listening, and it goes in on a different level. You know, that was my experience of the Tantric Path to Enlightenment, was kind of, yeah. You know, I've listened to the tapes since and read the book and all the rest of it. So that was one lecture. It was very, very, very creative lecture series. And then I was also went to the Sutra of Golden Light, which was done live in the Hampstead Town Hall, so a much bigger audience. It's not a lecture series. I mean, it's good in places, but yeah, didn't grab me totally. But the one that was stayed in my mind is the Vimalakirti Nidesha. So that was a little bit later, I think. I can't remember what year it is. I'm going to jump around in time. But that was in the East West Centre in Old Street in London. So it was quite a big hall. And so the order had been going kind of a few years by now, probably in it by now. I'll come back to joining the order, but I think I was an order member at that time. I don't know what year it was. Anybody remember what year that was?
79.
Hmm? 79, yes, I was already in the order. Yeah, so Bhante was in this, you could tell he was in this state of inspiration, and he said that, you know, he wrote that lecture series in a state of just exalted consciousness and inspiration, and week by week he just could feel that, you know, and it was a much bigger audience, and I had the sense that you could sort of hear a pin drop in the room, and that he's kind of lifted everybody kind of into some other world, into that Vimalakirti Nidesha world, and I have some friends who they were part of the West London Centre, and people would come from all over London, actually all over the country, to be at these lectures, and they would get in their van and drive off, and they got lost every week going home, because I guess, you know, it was just kind of affected. So Bhante's teaching was, it wasn't, you know, conceptual or academic, it was, yes, you learnt things, you learnt kind of facts, and you learnt the Dharma more deeply, but you were just, I suppose, transformed. That was my experience of being transformed by being in that kind of presence. So yeah, he's a great teacher, and he's taught in that way, lecture series, lectures, talks. And then a bit later on, I think he started to do seminars, so we'll come back to that. So anyway, we're back in 1970. I'm going to the centre, getting to know Bhante. I've been noticed. He's befriended me, you know, in some way. And then we were invited to dinner, Manju Vajra and I. Not ordained yet. Invited to dinner, because he lived in Muswell Hill in a small community. And so I'd only seen him really kind of more formally, I guess. He talked to me at a class a little bit, but he was always in his robes, even though, you know, he looked with long hair and everything. And I don't know, I was still quite inspired by Tibetan Buddhism, and I think I sort of had this weird fantasy that I'd go to his house and it would all be, I don't know, he'd be sitting on some sort of throne, I'd have some sort of, I don't know, I had some strange idea about what was going to go on, you know, the guru, all the rest of it. And I turned up, knocked on the door, and he answered the door in civvies, as it were, in a kind of, his polo neck, but trousers and a jacket, and said, "Oh, come in." So it was very informal, and then he was cooking the dinner, so he was standing at the gas stove, and he said, "Oh, I'm cooking macrobiotic, hope that's all right," because that was the thing at the time, macrobiotic food. I mean, you don't need to know what that was, it was just a fad, beans and rice. And, you know, I had eaten some macrobiotic food, but I kind of thought, you know, there's ketchup on the table, so that's interesting. Tomato ketchup and macrobiotics don't really go. So we sat down to have dinner, and yeah, it was just kind of friendly, informal dinner, talking about all sorts of things. So I think that was the beginning of having a sort of closer relationship with him. So I came along in 1970, and I got ordained in 1973, so quite a short time in terms of the ordination processes of today. I don't know what the average is, but I think it's about 7 years. Can be less. So Bhante, you know, he founded the order in 68. He'd founded the movement in 67. He'd ordained quite a lot of people in 68 and 69. So there was an order that he'd, you know, created, co-created, as it were. But when I came along, even in 1970, I guess I came along and thought this movement had been going forever. And then later on, of course, I realised that it was so young, it had only been going a couple of years. And there were order members on the retreats I went on, but some people had kind of drifted away, and some people, they didn't use their order name. So in a way, the order wasn't really kind of formed as a community. It was beginning, you know, but it was such early days. So I think he decided that he needed to get to know people better before he ordained them, because, yeah, people had kind of drifted. So he started to run a study group with some people, which I wasn't part of at that point. And then I guess there was a couple of years where there weren't any ordinations, and then on this retreat in 1972, in Easter 1972, there were four ordinations. And it was a bit like a kind of new beginning. He knew those people quite well. You know, I guess he thought they would stay with the process, as it were. And two haven't, so. So 1972 was a kind of interesting retreat, because the early retreats I went on, they were quite free, quite a little bit wild. Some of us were a little bit wild. And then I guess he must have thought, oh, I've got this bunch of young people, you know, they are a bit wild, but they're staying around and they're helping out, and it's time to kind of, you know, put the foot on the accelerator or something, or up the ante. So that retreat was quite different. So it was a big retreat, about 100 people on it, I guess. Same place as I'd first gone along to. But it's the first time we'd ever done triple meditations in the morning. So the mornings were silent triple meditations. The afternoons were quite intensive communication exercises. I don't know if people still do communication exercise, but they, you know, were quite intensive communication one-on-one that he kind of also facilitated. And then in late afternoon, we did the six element practice every day. So the six element practice these days is a practice, it's an insight practice. It's a reflection on the elements, and it's a reflection on spiritual death, really. So it's not something you do with beginners, but I guess, you know, Sangharakshita could kind of hold that situation. So there we all were, sitting in the shrine room 4 o'clock in the afternoon, doing this practice, and very, very strong, you know, I think, very, very silent, very still, and I think he apparently said to some order members on his team on that retreat, oh, I think there are moments during that period of meditation when everyone's in the second dhyana, so, very, very concentrated. So very, very strong retreat, and a kind of him, I guess he's saying, come on, okay, you've been around for a couple of years, you guys, now it's getting serious. Are you serious? You know, are you going to take this seriously? Are you up for it? So at the same time on that retreat, my relationship with my partner was getting a bit kind of... we hadn't split up, but you know, there was something going on between us. We were both on retreat. And Manju Vajra, he's a great storyteller, so do invite him to Croydon one day and get him to tell you the story of that retreat. But he just must have had some very strong experiences. And I mean, from the outside, you might think, oh, he's having a psychotic experience, but I think he just went to some sort of mythic, symbolic realm. And I found that quite difficult. But I noticed that Bhante was really, really kind to him. He really kind of looked out for him, and, you know, made sure he was all right. And I learned later, sort of, you know, would find him and talk to him and just kind of look after him while something was opening up, actually. And there was one day in the shrine room. So it was a big shrine room, and we'd sit facing forwards, and there was a bay window. So I'm kind of over here, and Bhante's kind of here, and Manju Vajra's right in the front. He starts to, Manju Vajra starts to sort of hyperventilate, so something's kind of very strong is going on, and I know it's him, and I'm a bit kind of, oh, what's happening? And I just sort of have my eyes open, and I noticed, it wasn't the end of a stage of meditation, but I noticed Bhante, he had a Vajra bell, not a gong. I noticed this hand pick up this Vajra bell, and he just leant forward and went ding, and he calmed down, he stopped. It's a very beautiful moment. There's something beautiful about the hand and the bell and the kindness, and I kind of relax and said, oh. it's okay. So very, very perceptive and kind and responsive. And after the meditation, he came to find me because I think he realised that I would be worried. And he was very, very reassuring. And yeah, he was kind of looking after Manju, who was fine. But he'll tell you a lot more one day if you can invite him about that whole experience. So that was 1972. We haven't got very far, have we? So we'd been living together, obviously, and then the new centre had started in Archway, and we'd looked for that centre and fundraised for that centre, and we'd been without a centre for a while when the Sakura Centre closed. So it was a centre in a residential area of North London, and in an area where the council were planning to pull down all these lovely old terraced houses that had housed multiple occupancy families and build horrible flats. And they'd sort of started to do that, and then they'd run out of money. So some people had already been moved out, and there were empty houses. So there was a big squatting community in that area of all kinds of people, and squatting in those days was a civil offence, not a criminal offence. You know, it was just something fairly easy to do. So we wanted to live around the centre, so we kind of squatted, you know, a whole number of those houses. So during the 5 years we were at that centre, I think we must have had five, six, maybe seven communities of kind of five or six people each living in the street or streets next to that centre. So it was the beginning of a very strong community, and we didn't have to pay rent, and we were, you know, quite appreciated by the local residents because we were quiet and nice. And weren't that wild though in those days. So yeah, the centre was there, and Bante lived, still lived in Muswell Hill, and just, you know, was around the centre quite a lot. So you could go and see him, or he'd come to the centre, he'd come. Maybe teach a class, but he'd sort of handed on the teaching to us, really. So I got ordained in 1973, and so my ordination process was another of these study groups with Bante. So he'd done one lot and got those people ordained, and then he started another study group, mixed study group. So we'd meet once a week, and I can't remember what we studied. So I guess it was a way of him getting to know us more deeply, you know, getting to know our understanding of the Dharma. But I think he was such a kind of presence to be in the presence of that sometimes I think we were a bit sort of blocked and didn't kind of, it wasn't very kind of lively. And so he came in one day and said, I'm going to give you a Dharma quiz. Mm-hmm. So to just find out what we knew, I guess, and I mean, none of the questions were that difficult, like what's the Eightfold Path and what's the Four Noble Truths and everything. But I was the Hermione Granger of my generation, so I knew all the answers. And that was interesting. And although, you know, Bante was such a great teacher and we listened to lots of his tapes, I think as a bunch of people, as a bunch of peers, we were very, very into meditation, a bit sort of Zen orientated, lots of sitting. Mm-hmm. Study was a bit kind of uncool. So when we got downstairs after the group, people said to me, "Oh, you've been studying." And I hadn't really. I just listened to lots of Dharma, and I just absorbed it, you know, in that kind of way. And that's the first stage of wisdom, is that you listen to the Dharma and sort of soak it up. So I hadn't really studied, but it had gone in and I remembered it. So that was my ordination process. and then Bante, I think I wanted to be ordained, and he gave me some feedback, and I'm sorry, I can't remember what he actually said to me or what it was about. I'm sorry about that. I would be honest if I could remember. But I took it seriously, and I thought, oh, I need to go away on solitary and kind of think about that. So I went on solitary and did whatever I was supposed to do. It was probably to do with confidence and, you know, having been so shy and beginning to come out a little bit more, and something, it was probably something around that. And I got back from solitary and I wrote to him and said, I've been on solitary, I think I've done, you know how you are when you're in your 20s, I think I've done what I need to do. And then I got a letter saying, and you'll be ordained, you know, in 6 weeks on a summer retreat. So during this time, and again, I'm not quite sure of time scales, but Bhante went off, he took a sabbatical. So he left London and he went to Cornwall for a year. So he left this new centre in the hands of quite new order members. I mean, he's brilliant at, kind of being there for people, but handing on responsibility. So I'm just going to go into a little aside here, because my generation of baby boomer order members who were the first order members in this movement are all, you know, getting a bit creaky now. And we need to bring on younger people, don't we? We need to kind of, of all ages, but kind of, yeah, we need to bring on younger people. So there's a guy in order called Mahaprabha who's quite, does a lot of business, you know, working in companies and business companies. And he said quite recently to us in the Preceptors College that you need to give responsibility to people in their 20s. You need to give it to them. Otherwise, you know, they don't get the experience. So hand over responsibility whenever you can, however you can. And be them, it doesn't matter if they fail, be with them when they fail, you know, kind of. So that was kind of interesting. And just thinking, wow, Sangharakshita, he just kind of has this new centre and he just goes to these people, been ordained a couple of years. Here's the centre, take it on. And of course we did. And yeah, you grow, don't you? You make mistakes. You know, we'd always go and ask him about things. But he's a very good model. So he went off to Cornwall for a year. And he came back for this summer retreat of the ordinations in 1973. So, there's a retreat had gone on, big mixed summer retreat, and then he just came for the ordinations. And I don't remember much about my private ordination. It's a very, very important event in one's life if you've been ordained, to sort of sit in an ordination room with your preceptor. I don't remember what the shrine was like. I know it was there somewhere, it was probably white, but I do remember very vividly sitting opposite Sangharakshita, and it's quite close, you know, here to here. I don't remember many of the words of the ceremony. I do know them now because I'm a preceptor myself and I've done that, you know, many, many times myself. But I just remember the experience of just feeling my aspiration, my kind of deep desire to go for refuge and to, you know, practice the Dharma life is being met, resonated with, witness we call it now. That was very strong. And there's a point in the practice where you're asked what, in the ceremony, what practice, what meditation practice would you like to take? And I said Green Tara, which is my practice, and he said, oh, no hesitation there then. I remember him saying that. Maybe he thought we should discuss it, but anyway. And then you come to the giving of the name. So he said, oh, I'm going to call you Dharma Dinner, looking at me sort of. So I was a bit, don't know what that means. And he said, well, it means giver of the Dharma. And he still looked like I would know who this person was. He said, oh, she was an enlightened person in the time of the Buddha, enlightened female nun in the time of the Buddha, and I still don't know who he's talking about. And he said, well, she's on page, I don't know, 229 of the survey of Buddhism. You know, I hope I haven't read the survey. Not going well, is it? Anyway, he said, you know, and it means giver of the Dharma and suitable name and so on. So in those days, after your private ordination, nowadays, you know, that all that's done in silence, and the public ordination probably takes place even a week later, a few days later. So you sit with that experience in silence of you've been given a name and you've got this practice and you've had this ceremony. But that didn't happen in those days. So I'm making myself a cup of hot chocolate in the kitchen after, and someone says, oh, what's your name then? Mm-hmm. Oh, Dharma Dinner. Oh, what does that mean? Giver of the Dharma. Oh, yeah, I think that's very appropriate for you. So that was interesting, because I think Bhante, one, he remembered the, I know all the answers. And secondly, I heard this later, that he'd been having an order meeting before the ceremonies, and they'd been talking about the qualities of the four people who were getting ordained. I think the names used to come to him just like that. And someone said to him, Oh yes, Dharma. She has Sheila. She has got a good grasp of the Dharma because Banti obviously felt that from the Hermione Granger, and she's read the survey 3 times. Oh. I hadn't read it at all. So. Anyway, so I like the sound of the name and I like the meaning, and it did. It was interesting because I felt I'd been at university and I'd kind of gone like that with kind of academia, but it did open up something else, I guess. I do love words, and I do love studying the Dharma, and I do love expressing the Dharma. So it was definitely my name, and I did resonate with it. And I went off on a holiday afterwards, and I read the Survey of Buddhism cover to cover, and loved it, and I've read it many times since. Okay, so that's me getting my bearings. Oh yes, Banti's never actually forgotten that experience of me being in that study group and knowing all the answers to the questions. So often when I see him, he remembers it. He makes some reference to it, you know. And I there was a period when I just thought, is he never going to forget that? You know? Clever dick, you know. And then one day he was visiting Tiruvannamalai, where I lived for many years, and he would visit regularly, and he was talking about his own memory, and he has a very visual memory, and I thought, oh, that's what happens when he sees me. You know, he recognises the hair and the glasses, even with the sight not so good, and he's just got a flash of that study group, you know. So it's lovely, isn't it? You know, I kind of thought, oh, it's fine, it's not the only thing he remembers or knows about me, but it's obviously kind of... stuck in his memory. I find that quite lovely these days. Yes, so Banti is a teacher. He's my teacher, and I've talked a bit about him giving lectures. But in just not long after I was ordained, I think at the end of 1973, he started to teach in seminars. So he'd get a bunch of people together, go off on retreat, take a Dharmic text, and unfold that text. So again, you've got all that material transcribed from the audio, and now it's all free on Free Buddhist Audio. You can read the seminars and so on. It's an enormous wealth of material. So I didn't go on the first seminar, that was on the Bodhicharavatara, but I did go on one in the following year on the Udana, which is a very early Pali text about, you know, the life of the Buddha, really, and the Buddha's interactions and the Buddha's teaching, very early in his kind of, the Buddha's career, as it were, before the Sangha forms, before things get bigger and before things get, you know, institutionalised, as it were. And we did it as a camping retreat. So Banti was, you know, back in Cornwall. He was living on a hut and a cliff down in Cornwall, and there was an order member living in a village nearby, so some people stayed with her, and the rest of us, we just kind of camped up the cliff from where Banti was and in a field. So it was very, very simple. We had our own tents, and we had one tent where we'd listen to him. It was about 8 of us, and he'd come up from his hut, and we'd sit in this tent. And in a way, the location suited the material, because, you know, it's about the Buddha just wandering very simply, wandering alone, before he's got much of a sangha. It's the Buddha as the kind of wandering shaman type figure. So it sort of really suited sitting in this tent listening to Banti. And I think because I'd had such an interest in Tibetan Buddhism, I went for refuge to the Buddha at my ordination, but I didn't have a very strong connection with the Buddha at that point, I don't think. I had a strong connection with Milarepa and Padmasambhava, who seemed sort of nearer to one's own experience in some ways, because they'd had difficulties. And the Buddha always seemed like, I don't know, someone who, I don't know, sails through life. It's not strictly true, is it? But that seminar, I think Banti unfolding those stories from the Pali Canon and the Buddha's interactions with people just really brought the Buddha alive, the historical Buddha alive for me. So that's stayed a very strong experience for me. So on seminars with Banti, you know, there's a text, and he would unfold a text. So you get a lot of Dharma, but you'd also, it would be discussion rather than him giving a lecture. You know, you'd be in dialogue, you'd be in discussion, you ask questions. And you ask questions about all sorts of things. So all through those seminars, people are asking Dharmic questions, but they're also asking questions, we were also asking questions about our lives at the time, our work in the movement, our teaching, you know, all sorts of things. So you're learning the Dharma, but you're also, I suppose, a very strong Sangha building going on there, and a very strong kind of clarification of principles, and just helping us kind of work with various aspects of our own difficulties in our life, and you know, we're trying to run centres and so on. So very, very full experience. How are we for time, by the way?
15-20 minutes.
Gone or left?
Left.
So I've been in a number of seminars with Bhante. I really appreciate having had that kind of experience. But again, people have often said to me, oh, it must have been wonderful to be in that situation with Sangharakshita. And it was, but again, I guess the strength of his... How to describe it, really? I suppose you just have a sense when you're with Bhante of someone, even now when he's kind of 90 and he's kind of frail and so on, you just have a sense of some... There's this vast kind of mind, you know, that's my sense of him, that, you know, I can't... There's no way I can... encapsulate that or understand that, and that when he was younger that would come through with a lot more energy. So again, you know, the falling asleep in the tantric series in a seminar, you kind of start to kind of whoa. And he would kind of chunk it down. So when you read seminars, sometimes you've got some wonderful material about his exploring Pratijatsamutpada conditionality in a new way. And then a couple of pages later, he's talking about duvet covers and how we could import duvet covers from India. And when you read it, you think, what are they doing? It's kind of, he just could see, I guess, that people were coming from. And he just kind of, you know, okay, calm it down for a bit and just chat for a bit. And then we'll kind of, you know, so very kind of sensitive. Yeah. So lots of teaching in that way, which is very, very important for the development of our community. So one of my great sort of gratitudes towards Bhante is that he's been very kind to me throughout my order life. And when I first came along, I said I was very shy and you know, quite troubled, actually. And I think he sort of met that. So there's a couple of incidents that I'll just tell you. So one was, and my health was really bad. I had very bad health. So he'd rung me up at a community I was living in to ask me if I would organise a convention that was coming up. And I was just really not very well, and I was really not very well that day. So I answered the phone, and I so wanted to do it, and I just couldn't, you know, I knew I couldn't. I burst into tears over the phone saying, oh, I can't do it. I don't even know if I can come on this convention. I'm just not in good shape. And he said, you must come. And you must come and have no responsibilities. You must come. You know, get someone to come with you. So I went on the convention. I'm really glad I went. And when I got there, I discovered that he'd organised me to have a single room. And someone said, oh, and when he'd sort of found the single room and organised it for me, he'd sat on the bed, you know, to make sure it was a comfortable bed. So there's that kind of care, you know. And I don't know if it was embarrassed or something, you know, I was embarrassed or ashamed that I was kind of not in good nick. So it was emotionally as well as physically. So I avoided him on the convention, you know, that kind of... And he just wouldn't let me get away with that. He would kind of come and find me and make sure I was all right and so on. So, you know, I've been on the receiving end of great kindness from him. Great kindness when my dad died, great kindness when my mum died. You know, in those sort of situations in life, you know, he would just be very kind. And I wrote to Bhante. I don't do it now, hardly ever, but for many, many years I wrote to him. God, there's the new library at Astana, it got all his correspondence in it, and I passed, last time I was at, and I passed the filing cabinet with all his correspondence, and I said to Dharmasamudra, I'd love to get all that back, because you think, oh, it's kind of there for posterity. And I was very, very open with him. I just wrote about everything, you know, I'm in my 20s, 30s, you know. Everything, love affairs, broken hearts, whatever, you know, he got it all, really. So I guess, you know, he knows me, and, you know, then he'd respond to whatever was going on very kindly. But yes, I think, embarrassing. So that's one occasion where he was very kind. There have been many. Another, which was both kindness and great perception, I think, was later on. I'd been in a meeting at the London Buddhist Centre. I'm not quite sure which year we're in, but it was a mixed meeting, and one of the guys, who was all older members, had said something about me, about women, spiritual life, that had really upset me, deeply, deeply upset me. And the next day, I think, I was going on a seminar with Bhante, and I was kind of organising it, and I was looking after the taping and organising his interviews as he met people every day. So I sat with this unpleasant, painful, disturbing, upsetting experience until right at the end of the retreat, and when I went to see him. And by that time, I'd managed to kind of formulate a good question. So my question to him was, you know, this incident happened. I don't want you to referee. I don't want you to tell me who's right or wrong. But why does it impact so strongly on me? Why does it upset me so deeply? Which is a good question. And he looked at me and said, you have lots of self-doubt. And that might have been obvious to everybody else, but it wasn't obvious to me. It's like sometimes when you're in a kind of miasma of hindrance or whatever, you haven't labelled it, you don't know what it is, you just suffer because of that. So yes, I did have a strong inner critic and so on, and it was a bit like, oh, wow. You know, it's like I understood something about myself, labelled. So what do I do about that? And he said, you need lots of unconditional love. Well, I burst into tears. I take him a cup of tea, and he gave me his hanky. He said, when you go back to London, you need to tell those people that you need lots of encouragement. I thought, well, I'm not doing that. But I think he probably did that, actually, behind the scenes. And as I left the room, I gave him back his hanky, and I took the teacup, and he sort of followed me out the room, you know, kind of, oh, you all right, sort of thing. So there was kind of a strong perception about me and my character, which I had lots of instances I've had with Sangharakshita, and then this, you know, incredible kind of kindness around that. So I'm very grateful to him for his kindness. Which is, I don't know, let's see what else we've got there. So I've worked with Bhante as well. The other things I've done is, apart from, you know, worked sort of closely with him in various kind of responsibilities throughout my order life. So quite early on I became overall women's mitra convener. We don't have one of those now, but sort of for the globe, as it were. There's a lot less mitras in those days. So, you know, I would meet mitras, I would do retreats for mitras, and I'd kind of, you know, Bhante couldn't know all the women mitras, but I'd kind of be a sort of intermediary, helping him get to know people who were coming up for ordination, helping him organise seminars for women order members and mitras. So that went on for quite a long time, actually, 7 years, and I travelled a lot doing that. So that was, you know, very, very positive. And then, after about 7 years of that and a lot of travelling, I just felt, again, my health wasn't very good. I just felt, oh, I need to be in one place. I was always away from my community. I need to be living with people, living with friends, be in one place, kind of look after myself a bit better, which I wasn't very good at, and kind of, yeah, have a different kind of life. And initially, he wasn't very keen on that. So I think, he knew he was going to lose someone that, you know, was a kind of, he was able to work with and through with the women in the movement. And I went to see him, I tried to talk to him about it. And again, one of Bhante's great skills is he can sort of deflect things. Mm-hmm. Well, like Tai Chi, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So I go, I think I need to stop doing this. And you kind of think, oh, I have to go. Mm-hmm. And I just had to keep going and tell him, you know, what was wrong with me. I wasn't sleeping, and my health, and so on and so forth. But I think he really wasn't keen to lose that working relationship. But eventually, he understood, and he was very kind. He said, "Of course, you must stop." So then, I had a gap of not working with him quite so directly. But then I got involved in ordination training for women, and again, working with Bhante very, very closely. on the ordination team at Tiruvannamalai as a private and public preceptor. So it's a different. It's the same. There's a kindness, there's a perception, but a slightly different kind of relationship. You know, I felt in the early days of being on the ordination team that Bhante was kind of training us to, you know, recognise the effect of going for refuge in people. That he'd ordained, you know, 350 people, first 350 people in the order, and now I'm handing that responsibility over to you. So you go to him and say, I think this person is ready. And he'd ask you all sorts of really pertinent questions. Have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? What's their contact? You know, so you kind of think, oh, I really need to be more thorough. So I feel I was sort of trained well, as it were, in that sort of way, to work in that sort of way. Yeah, and I'm still, you know, I'm a public preceptor, I'm a private preceptor. I have that sort of working relationship with Bhante, not quite so close because he's, you know, he doesn't... he's not around so much, but he's still very, very interested in the order that he's founded. And that's one thing I'll say about Bhante, is that he's just always been there. He founded this order, didn't he? And he's not been a sort of jet-setting guru. He has travelled to different parts of the movement, but he's just been there, teaching us the Dharma, teaching us how to build Sangha. You know, if he thought there was an aspect of the Dharma that we weren't practicing, he'd give a talk on it, just things like gratitude. He thought that we weren't expressing enough gratitude, so he gives us a Dharma talk on gratitude, where it comes from in the text, and, you know, how to develop that sort of, you know, so many, many things like that. And he's just been there, in the past, you know, he was very involved. He was president of every centre. He read the minutes of every centre. He knew exactly what was happening. And he would follow things up. You know, he would follow things up to make sure, I guess, that, you know, we were practicing well and practicing according to certain principles. So he's been a kind of very kind of consistent presence in all our lives, even if he's distant to us. And he still is. He's still producing papers alongside Subhuti. He's still got thoughts about things. Still communicating. So, yeah, my personal relationship with him hasn't always been completely straightforward. I mean, I've talked about a lot of positive aspects, but I think at a certain point, I'm not quite sure when this was, but I had sort of various sort of troubling aspects of my own sort of past and childhood. And even though Bhante's like 21 years older than me, I think it was a phase where I projected father onto him. You know, I just got into all sorts of complications around father and authority and da da da. And again, I think Bhante's very good at not taking projections. You know, they just don't stick somewhere. So yeah, I had a bit of sort of difficulty there around that, and I realised at some point, oh, I'm expecting all sorts of things from him that it's not about that, and trying to clarify that in myself. So there was a period where I kind of withdrew, I think. I stopped writing so much. I stopped doing all this, you know, stream of consciousness letters that are in the filing cabinet. and just thought, oh, come on, you know, I need to kind of internalise something and grow up a bit. So there's two aspects to that. So back to the kind of Bhante on that convention, finding me the single room, you know, the bed, looking after me and so forth. In one of those moments with him where he came to find me and asked me if I was all right, I had this kind of, oh, he's like the father I've never had or something. There was something about the quality of the interaction that he sort of did it, even though he could also not take projection. And something, you know, resolved there to some extent. But then later I got back caught up in that again. And then I don't know, maybe a few years went by, I think, where I was less kind of moving towards him. And I wrote to him and said, oh, this is what's been going on for me. You know, I've been trying to work this out. And, you know, I got a letter back saying, oh, that's really good to know that. Because I kind of thought he'd know and understand and, you know, intuit and all the rest of it. Of course, that's not necessarily so. So he wrote back and said, it's really good to know that, because I this is Bantam talking, I was beginning to feel that our inner connection was kind of, was not so strong. It's very, yeah, I was very sort of touched by that, but of course he's a human being on the other end of that relationship, and you can have all sorts of expectations of someone who's so much more developed than you and your teacher, but you know, yeah, the relationship is important to him, and I realised that and thought, oh yeah, I need to take that into account. So Bante this year turns 90. He's living at Astana. He's still seeing people. If you want to see Sangharakshita, just email Ashwajit, and you know, if he's willing to see you, he'll see you. Don't wait to be invited, as it were, because that might not happen. But he's able to say no, he's not up to it, or he's not well that day. But he's still seeing people, and people maybe these days, it always used to get an hour or longer, but it might only be 15 minutes. But people new to our movement, people of young women on the course up there at the moment, he's seeing all of them. They may only get 15 minutes, but they come away and they're really, really appreciative of having met Bante as he is now. He's always got something interesting to say. He's very perceptive. He's a very good communicator. He can meet all kinds of different people where they need to be met. And he's still with us. So that's a fantastic resource for all of us. So listen to his tapes, read his books, read his poetry, follow his teachings, and if you want to, email, see if you can go and see him. I'll stop there. I'm sure there are other things I could have said, many things, but yeah.
Excuse me, I've got...